It's Wednesday, February 26, 2020, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Monique Luisi. On our program this week, Elizabeth Warren called for Michael Bloomberg to release women from non-disclosure agreements to let them talk about their experiences working for him and his companies. And he did for three women, at least. We're going to talk about these documents, the decision, and why others are now also choosing to drop them. We'll also talk about a video that Bloomberg posted to Twitter that was edited in a way that's a bit deceptive. And a month from now, it would be labeled as such on Twitter if he were to post it again. And the Netflix Top 10, the company will soon release a weekly list of the most popular programming in each country that it serves. What might that do to influence viewing behaviors? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll be able to talk about before our half hour is up today. But we're going to start with Monday's guilty verdict in the case against Harvey Weinstein. He was found guilty on Monday by a New York jury of rape and criminal sexual conduct. That verdict was announced, among other places, before a live studio audience at The View. This was on ABC Monday morning.
The verdict in the Harvey Weinstein rape trial just came in. He was found guilty of a in the first degree and rape in the third degree. We will be right back.
So there wasn't much more discussion after that break that Whoopi Goldberg had tossed you, because the show was pretty much over at that point. You were able to hear that spontaneous reaction of the people in the studio audience, and some other circles' reaction was a little bit more mixed, that there was disappointment to think that there were guilty verdicts in only two of the five charges against him, that it didn't go quite far enough. I, on the other hand, started answering back to some of those people and saying it only takes one to be guilty. And he left there and was taken straight to Rikers Island. That's a message being sent there.
Yeah, especially Rikers. I mean, I think this is the reaction that you showed, I think, is really telling. Mm-hmm. Because I think the fact that a white man who is in a position of power was found guilty of anything in a case involving an allegation by a woman, is different. And it certainly feels different to a lot of women. So I think just the fact that there was that level of surprise, I think, and some elation or relief, it says a lot about the way the power structures worked up until now.
Definitely. It's saying that we're moving in the right direction. And sure, it's not going to be enough to make up for the injustices that have happened, but we are moving in a step in the right direction. But we still also have to wait till sentencing. Mm-hmm. Because I believe he's facing between a combination of 8 and 32 years altogether, be told. So I'm sure these conversations are going to come up again about whether or not he's being sentenced enough for the crimes for which he was found guilty for.
Yeah, and I think the equity issue will come up there, too. I mean, we just had a story this week in Columbia, Missouri, about a man who was paroled and now is working as a, you know, has recaptured his life, and he's working as a solid citizen and supporting a family, and he might get sent back to jail on a technicality because a judge has ruled that, oh, you didn't interpret the parole laws correctly, and he happens to be a black...
another judge did
right.
not interpret
yes, them. Yes, thank you. And he happens to be a black man who was charged on drug offenses on sentencing guidelines that everybody from Donald Trump to the ACLU thinks are outmoded. So really, I think we need to watch and say, I agree with Monique, you know, what really will be the outcome in terms of the sentencing? But you can tell by the reaction in that tape that you played that this is something that feels different for a lot of women.
Well, and that in that court of public opinion as well, that the sympathy isn't there. There, people don't have empathy for him in the same way that they might in the case you're talking about here locally. Saw an editorial or a political cartoon, editorial cartoon that was online yesterday that showed two stagehands outside of the props department at a Hollywood movie studio walking away with a walker saying, well, you won't need this one anymore. Just kind of speaking to some of the theatrics that had gone on here and how people weren't really buying into them, and that empathy, that sympathy isn't, he doesn't have that in that court of public opinion. There's another part of this too. There's a photo that's on our Lynx blog that showed what was going on kind of in the newsroom, the media access room in that courthouse, and where people were covering it. And every single person in that photo was a woman. And that not everybody covering the story was a woman, but really the impact that women in our profession have had in covering this story as well, straight through to this point. And for me, that was empowering to see, too.
Yeah, I think it's good in a way. It's concerning in a way because we can't win equity fights, which I think are important for everybody. You can't enforce equal justice under law unless everybody buys in. Mm-hmm. So I think certainly, though, men have had a big role. Obviously, men have been in some decision-making positions in newsrooms in deciding how to play the story. One of the lead reporters in breaking some of these stories is a man, Ronan Farrow. So I think it's important. It's great that women are involved, and the fact that women are more involved in making decisions in newsrooms, I think, raises the level of this as a story. But it's also important, I think, socially, that we're all a part of this, that it's not seen as just a woman's issue, that this is important for everybody.
Oh, absolutely. Sexual assault is not a woman's issue alone. Women aren't the only victims. Men are victims. Trans people are victims. People who don't identify as any particular end of the spectrum are also victims. It's a matter of those voices being heard and everybody being involved in the conversation. So while it's wonderful that women have a bigger voice, it cannot be at the expense of everyone else being involved in the conversation. So hopefully this just makes the table bigger, but not exclusive.
And that's another one of the stories on our Lynx blog too, was encouraging people to come forward on every single end of that spectrum, including some of the other victims of Kevin Spacey or other people who may have been victimized, who may not fall on a gender binary and may not feel that there is a safe space in which to come forward with these, which kind of brings us a little bit to think about what becomes that next phase of the Me Too movement, about covering that as journalists, that where and how do we create that safe space for people to do that and tell those stories?
It's going to be challenging because one thing that socially outside of journalism that is not really attended to all the time is what happens to the people after the courtroom, after the press has quieted down. What is going on in these people's lives? Because there's still institutions and social structures that can make it difficult for people who've spoken out, especially against people who have power and money and all the resources that people like Weinstein and Kevin Spacey have that they may not.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Monique. And it's a good thing for journalists to go back and check and see what is the story 1 year, 2 years, 3 years later. Just to channel Ernest, who's not with us this week, it's not about you, but it's also a not you win the fight, but then you have to make sure that you keep winning, that we have a tendency as human beings to backslide, and we have to make sure that doesn't happen.
See, and one of the reasons I was saying it's not about you is my first thought too in channeling Ernest, who is out of town this week, was that idea that it isn't about us. We've started to do a really good job of covering Hollywood, of covering the networks with the Matt Lauers, with other people who have since been the Charlie Roses, who have been removed from some of those environments. But we haven't done a really good job yet of covering this issue in other industries, of looking at hotel workers who are in hotel rooms in off hours overnight. Some of the most vulnerable and those with the least amount of power. We haven't done a really good job of telling their story and helping this tide shift to favor them as well. Mm. So let's kind of rewind to last week when we met and we talked about how we were looking forward to the Democratic debates and to see what would happen when the field of Democrats had their shot at Michael Bloomberg. Well, now they've had two of them. Last week, it took Elizabeth Warren all of about a minute, maybe a minute and a half, to lay into him for the sexist comments and culture of harassment that took hold in his companies. Warren called on him to release people from non-disclosure agreements right there on the spot. He didn't. I mean, it was like the most awkward stare into a camera I've seen in a long time. He didn't do it, but he has since said there are three people. We talked about dozens of cases, but there are three people that he will let out of those non-disclosure agreements, provided they ask. My first thought on that one, and I would ask you about this, why then, again, pull that power move of saying you have to ask? Is it just opposed to writing up the legal documents to let it go?
Yeah, well, because asking gives you an opportunity to try to persuade them not to ask, right? And the other thing I think, and I think you saw this come up a little bit in last night's debate, the question is three women. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like these are cases that involve Mike Bloomberg personally, but he runs a very large company. And how many NDAs have been signed with women who work for that company? Because, and I think that was the point that some of his rivals are trying to make, if you run a company, if you're going to take credit for all of the success, which Mike Bloomberg has been doing, you then need to be responsible for the culture and what did you do to establish that culture. So just saying three people, it sounds like we're not getting the whole story.
We're not getting the whole story. And I watched the debate last night and Bloomberg said something to the effect of, I don't remember what happened. I'm sorry for what they think they may have heard. And that's not a great PR strategy, first of all, one. And two, I would imagine that it further entrenches those feelings of what these women said was in their heads and not real.
It's a gaslighting.
Yes, it's gaslighting right at its most unfortunate finest.
So he's not alone in this move at the moment. Condé Nast, one of the largest magazine publishers in the world, has announced that it is going to begin releasing people in its employ or who have left the company from these non-disclosure agreements as well. And there's some history and some context there. Condé Nast, of course, being the owner of The New Yorker, where Ronan Farrow broke a lot of this news. It's a show of leadership in a way for them to step forward like that.
Yeah, you know, I think these agreements, my guess is that they were originally started, I'm not sure, but as a way, and I can understand this, as a way to protect corporate secrets. Okay, if I work in a place and I know what stories are going to be published over the next year, or I know about some special technology, I shouldn't be allowed to disclose that to a rival if I leave. But this is really, they've come to be used to restrain free speech, which really is so fundamental to our democracy, and to really muzzle criticism of companies. And that too, I mean, you know, I think what has made our country strong is the fact that we're willing to take criticism and we speak truth to power. And these agreements just do exactly the opposite. They say, no, we can't handle this and we don't want to hear it. So if a non-disclosure agreement is to protect a legitimate corporate patent or you know, intellectual property, fine. But if it's to keep somebody from speaking out, not so fine.
But something about something tangible as opposed to a behavior.
Yeah, and I just don't know if this is a case of mission creep or but it's abusive, I think.
It will be interesting to see which way things go, because it seems that before the idea was, okay, we're going to keep things quiet to make our company look better, but people want more transparency. And that is now what, with the audiences having the power, they can make those demands, mm-hmm. and corporate is following.
Okay, so let's back it up a minute and talk about Bloomberg again. There have been a couple of developments in the past couple of days as it relates specifically to his campaign and its social media efforts. One of those that is especially notable is that Twitter is blocking approximately 70 accounts that are run by pro-Bloomberg people wanting to verify that these are real people, that these are their messages, because so many of these messages appear to be exactly the same, that they're trying to make sure that it's not a violation of the terms of service of just spamming people with the exact same content. And I was reading through it and thinking about it. How is this any different than maybe some of those Russian bots interfering? These are just real people clicking the buttons.
It's a fine line. Politicians have had a history of mastering and using the media to their advantage. Bloomberg would probably be upset that I'm calling him a politician, but let's say political contenders they try to figure out. I mean, the classic example is how Kennedy knew about the camera and television and makeup, and he looked better in debates than Nixon. So there's a question of media and reporting and ethics here that we have to consider, especially with social media, where it's a context where the rules of social media have not caught up to what is going on social media. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of how do you navigate that space? I mean, is what he's doing technically wrong? Well, we would have to look at the terms of service. Is what he's doing ethically wrong? Well, that depends on if we're talking about ends or means. It's a difficult question.
Yeah, I think social media, unlike other media, is the Wild West in terms of regulation. So if you buy a TV ad, and certainly Michael Bloomberg has bought plenty of them, you're going to see a bug at the end or some kind of an identifier telling you this is who bought this ad. Not so much on social media. And what we've really seen, and the Daily Beast had a really good piece on this early on, is how the Bloomberg folks are going out. And because he has limitless amounts of money, apparently, he's going out to these sites like Tribe, where people who want to be social media influencers gather, and they're kind of making matches. So, and the Bloomberg people are sending out all of these suggested messages that you can put on your social media feed about Mike. Well, a lot of the social media networks now, and I think this gets into the issue of transparency, Monique, are now starting to self-regulate and say, if you are being paid to post this message, we want you to say that. And but a candidate like Bloomberg, who has a lot of money, it's harder to track what he's doing online than it would be if we were talking about TV ads.
Mm. Well, and so again, Twitter starting to self-regulate, has this new rule coming into effect next month that if you post something that is or could be deceptively edited, it will label it as such. And there was a video that went up last week where he, and by he I mean his campaign, had edited a clip from the debate, and I would show it and play it, but it would make some pretty bad radio. So I'll describe it. He's asking that question, who here else has started a business and been in that startup or that entrepreneurial mode? And so the next thing you then see for the next 24 seconds is blank looks on the faces of each of the other candidates. Well, that's not really how it played out. And so Twitter is saying not so much anymore.
Yeah, so they took snippets of the candidates' faces from other elements or other moments in the debate and edited it together to, as one writer put it, look like Bloomberg had this fantastic mic drop moment, you know, and he didn't. So, I think that was deceptive editing. It was a deceptive video, and it should be called out as such.
It's deceptive, but also I can't help but I have two questions. One, is he trying to be a comedian? Because he also made a comment in the debate last night that he was surprised that the other candidates had showed up after the beating he gave them last week. And I was just like, okay.
And this is the guy whose Wikipedia page was changed with the date of his death and cause of death, Elizabeth Warren.
Right.
Right.
And okay. So that's my first question.
That's the problem with Wikipedia.
right there. Yes.
And then two, what is he trying to accomplish with that? I mean, but is he also playing by the playbook of President Trump? Because President Trump has done some of these tactics and they've been proven effective. So is he doing the same thing, trying to make it make it work for him?
Well, I think the irony is that Bloomberg is a candidate who has got in the race to supposedly save the country from Trump. You know, that's his calling card. Mm-hmm. I can make this happen. I can win. And yet, I think Monique is right. He's employing some tactics.
The exact same playbook that
looks
we saw.
Very familiar. Yeah. So how is that going to change things?
Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, time will tell.
Yeah. Let's move a little bit.
Or the voters.
The voters, yes.
Let's move a little bit further to the left, specifically to the coverage of Bernie Sanders' campaign, and even more specifically to that coverage on MSNBC. Chris Matthews apologized Monday night for an analogy he made during the live coverage of Sanders' big win in the Nevada caucuses on Saturday, comparing Sanders' overwhelming margin of victory to a Nazi invasion.
Before getting into tonight's news, I want to say something quite important and personal. As I watched the one-sided results of Saturday's Democratic caucus in Nevada, I reached for an historical analogy and used a bad one. I was wrong to refer to an event from the last days, or actually the first days of World War II. Senator Sanders, I'm sorry for comparing anything from that tragic era in which so many suffered, especially the Jewish people, to an electoral result in which you were the well-deserved winner. This is going to be a hard-fought, heated campaign of ideas. In the days and weeks and months ahead, I will strive to do a better job myself of elevating the political discussion. Congratulations, by the way, to you, Senator Sanders, and to your supporters on a tremendous win down in Nevada.
So it was definitely not a good analogy. What about the apology?
I think he had to make it. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, look, journalists, particularly journalists on live television, are going to make mistakes. And I think one of the problems, and it's certainly something I talk to our students about, is increasingly journalists are being pushed to be edgy. And we can talk a lot, and we have talked here about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's part of the economics of the news business. And this effort to stand out, and sometimes when you do that, you fall off the tightrope, and you just have to hope there's a safety net out there. So, I think the fact that he had a chance to give an apology, mm-hmm. Is a good thing, and it's good that he did it.
It's good that he did an apology, but I can't help but wonder if Bernie Sanders weren't Jewish, would that analogy had been made? I can't help but wonder sometimes, because of the recall that we have with specific people, mm-hmm. specific examples that come up. I'm not saying that he's anti-Semitic, Chris Matthews, not in the least. I'm just saying the association.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of saw it in some of the explanations, not excuses, but explanations for this analogy, was that it was about the overwhelming support, as if anybody, like, as though it was an election that was fixed. Like, nobody was going to come up or speak against him.
But there's so many examples of overwhelming support that could have been raised. Why that one in particular?
I think the other thing that's really problematic about that analogy is that it's negative. Mm-hmm. You know, there are ways you could say that someone won overwhelmingly, like, and say that would be a positive. But this is where I think the Sanders supporters are rightfully upset. It's this notion that somehow it's a terrible thing if Bernie Sanders wins. That's not for a journalist to say.
Well, it's a backhanded
compliment. That's another part, too, of this criticism, is the idea that Sanders can't seem to get a win, if you will, on MSNBC, and that even the pundits that are brought on, that there's never really anyone to provide his point of view in those conversations and to bring some of that balance in some ways. Go ahead.
I think part of what happens here is, and it's we've seen it happen in other campaigns, journalists have a tendency to be comfortable with the establishment because they've built up sources in the establishment. Mm-hmm. They know who to talk to. They know what, and I would say, you know, I've done this political coverage, so I have some sense for what's going on here. But really, journalists need to get used to talking to outsiders, because if you look back, I would argue that since 1976, every single person who won the presidency came from the outside, with two exceptions, and both of them were named Bush. In some ways, every president since 1976 has been a vote by citizens for an anti-establishment move. People have been saying in America for a long time, we want change. Mm-hmm. And so journalists need to get used to getting outside of that comfort zone and being willing to reach out to people who maybe aren't in their little black books or the digital equivalent thereof.
Okay, so our next topic is for all the Netflix bingers out there. Netflix has announced this week that they're going to start publishing a weekly top 10 list of the most popular programs that are available on that platform in each of the countries where it's available. And it's a move towards transparency because Netflix has often been criticized for not making clear what traffic looks like to its sites and how people are using it. I wonder from the consumer point of view, and Monique, especially having sat in on one of your classes yesterday where that idea of bias comes in, how might publishing a list like this actually influence the user behavior in terms of what they watch and how that might become manipulated data going, behaviors manipulated going forward?
That's a big question that
I cannot cover in two and a half minutes.
Except to say that it might confirm that different movies and different type of media are going to be more popular. But the danger is that it can be used as data is saying, well, this movie is inherently more popular, therefore we should continue to create movies or content like this that could advance harmful stereotypes or harmful messages. That's the worst case scenario. The best case scenario is that it advances positive messages and gets people to look at, okay, well, this is the content that's popular in other places. Maybe I should branch out and look at other content. So it really depends on how the data is used.
Okay. Whatever happened to the long tail? I mean, that was the idea. I think the danger to me is that popular content sort of builds on itself, mm-hmm. and then you don't have any room for people to experiment because they'll just follow the herd.
Absolutely.
Okay. Before we go today, a tribute to one of our colleagues here at the Jay School. And it's a man that whom I had worked with at the Chicago Tribune dating back to 2000. Mark Hinojosa died last Thursday at his Columbia home after a lengthy battle with cancer. Mark joined us on the faculty here back in 2015 after spending some time at the Detroit News. Before that, 17 years at the Chicago Tribune, where he was associate managing editor for multimedia, and before that, of the photo department. Mark was also on staff at the Kansas City Star in the early 1980s, where he was part of the team that won the Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the Hyatt Regency Hotel disaster. Mark is survived by his wife, three children, and two sisters.
We will miss him.
Special person.
Yes, he really cared a lot about representation in the business. And so I had an opportunity to serve on a panel with him and just his passion, even though I didn't know at that time that he had an illness, actually. All I could see was his passion, and it was just very touching finding out afterward that I sat next to somebody who was really passionate about his cause.
He was a great mentor. I think Markina has had a wonderful career as a photographer, and then he had another life mentoring younger journalists, and as you say, Monique, particularly journalists who have been underrepresented in newsrooms, and he wasn't the guy with cancer, he was the guy with the camera, and that's why we'll miss him. All that energy.
Well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more on each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, and see previews of what we'll be talking about next week. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and Aaron Hay for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our theme music. We'll see you next time.